Reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 7, Scheduled Incarnations with Specific Functions. It's text number 12 this morning. Translation. At the end of the millennium, the would-be, means the Vaivasvata Manu, to come, the would-be Vaivasvata Manu of the name Satyavrata would see that the Lord in the fish incarnation is the shelter of all kinds of living entities up to those in the earthly planets. Because of my fear of the vast water at the end of the millennium, the Vedas come out of my, that is Brahma's, mouth, and the Lord enjoys those vast waters and protects the Vedas. Srila Prabhupada's purport. During one day of Brahma, there are 14 Manus, and at the end of each Manu, there is a devastation up to the earthly planets, and the vast water is fearful even to Brahma. So in the beginning of the would-be Vaivasvata Manu, such devastation would be seen by him. There would be many other incidences also, such as the killing of the famous Shankasura. This foretelling is by the past experience of Brahmaji, who knew that in the fearful, devastating scene, the Vedas would come out of his mouth. But the Lord, in his fish incarnation, not only would save all living entities, namely the demigods, animals, men, and great sages, but would also save the Vedas. So there's in the 8th canto, the last chapter of the 8th canto, 24th, is a further description of Matsya Avatar, the Lord's fish incarnation. And Maharaj Parikshit asked to hear about this one, asking the question that occurs to everybody, why would the Lord accept a low-class form of a fish, Tamaha, in the mode of ignorance? What did he do this for? People are sometimes distressed by these accounts that the Lord appears a fish, tortoise, pig. Pig is not, has very bad press. I mean, the boar being a guy is somewhat okay, but still. Still, it's big. Why he takes these various incarnations? The answer is, why not? Who writes the rules around here? So if he wants to, he can do it. And it says here he came to play in the water, so it is definitely the fact that the Lord has a very playful and sportive spirit, which he sometimes exhibits in this way by taking on these various forms. God definitely has a sense of humor, so that's also on exhibit, and plus just his expansiveness. There's an argument made by Mayavadis against the idea of a personal God. God is a person, or let's say an individual. Because they say that if God is a person, an individual, that means it would automatically be limited. Because to be an individual means that you're a this as opposed to a that. So there has to be a boundary. I mean, there has to be some limit to define individuality. And so, so therefore, just from that idea, since God is, or the Absolute Truth anyway, is unlimited, he cannot be a person. This argument was presented by a Lutheran theologian from Germany, Paul Tillich, came to America. And although he was a Christian, in name anyway, nominally a Christian, his speculations were all quite impersonal. So he actually said in this way, he argued in this way, that God cannot be the supreme being among all beings. Can you imagine a Christian saying that? That God cannot be the... Therefore, he's known as a liberal Christian, which means a Mayavadi. You have two kinds of Christians, Mayavadis and fundamentalists, apparently. They say God cannot be the supreme being among all beings because that would limit him to being one among many. So therefore, he said, God is being itself. Or later on, he said, the ground of all being. And being itself, you could say, is sort of Brahman. Just Brahman. And what is wrong with this argument is that if God cannot be the supreme being among all beings, that's also a limitation. Just being itself doesn't sound so hot to me. And then you mean, well, just a sort of kind of energy. And sometimes we used to hear people say like this, oh, I think God is just energy. Notice the word just. Already less than what we are. We're people with senses and everything, but God is just energy. And the Vedic, the real response to this, for those who understand the Vedas, is that what Tillich has done is set up a false dilemma, that you can be one or the other. But actually, God is both. He's simultaneously the supreme being among all beings, and he's being itself. So we express this by saying that nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. So he has it both. You would say that if God is an individual, then he's limited. There's a person, there's his boundary, and then there's his environment, there's other people. But those, his environment, the world, the creation, is Krishna in another form. That's why there's nothing but Sri Krishna. It's his energy, so it's himself in another form. Yet he remains, there's nothing, the supreme. There's nothing but Sri Krishna, yet actually nothing is Sri Krishna, save and except his own primeval personality. So this way, he's not limited at all. These other conceptions are quite limiting. Most people's idea of a personal God, really, they're thinking of a kind of a demigod, really. Because they don't understand that this person is the Absolute Truth, that is the ultimate source of all energies. The idea of God, the conception of God, Ishwara, a controller, and the conception of the Absolute Truth are not on the same level. Because there can be, in principle, be many Ishwaras. But there, in principle, there can be only one Absolute Truth. The Absolute Truth was the one that from whom everything comes. That's the notion there. So, and then there's another sense too. Why Krishna has so many expansions and expansions of expansions and avatars. Again, He has form, but anantarupam, his form is endless. Just you say, oh, well, if the Lord is bluish-black, that would limit him. Oh, here's a red incarnation, here's a green incarnation, here's a yellow incarnation. He's got so many, the rainbow coalition, as they say. All the colors are there. And all the forms are also there. And there are also many forms of the Lord about which we know nothing. This Bhagavatam, here on earth, is only partial. There are many more volumes in the heavenly planets, even. If this is the biography of God, and God is unlimited, you can understand that any biography we're going to have is going to be somewhat partial. And there's always more to know. So, that's why we say a fish. Why not? Why not a fish? This is part of his expansiveness. He's just not some proper Victorian gentleman, stuffy. And the philosopher Nietzsche is supposed to have said that I would be able to believe in a God who could dance. He's the famous, you know, God is dead. Haven't these people heard that God is dead? He had a big case against God. And I guess he thought he was some real stuffy bureaucrat or Victorian grandfather or something, just sitting up in his chair, scowling at everybody and saying, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. He can't. Of course God dances. That's how we can dance, because God dances. So we have the Lord appears as this fish. If this is amazing and extraordinary, if it, as we used to say, blows your mind, that's all the more reason to accept that it's true. Why does God have to be limited to the narrow compass band of some shopkeeper's understanding? He's amazing. So he appeared, therefore, as a fish, and not just once, actually, but twice. Because it turns out that there are this account in the Bhagavatam, the English word is conflates, it merges together, two different incidences. And in the commentary, Prabhupada says how Jiva Goswami and other people have, Rupa Goswami, sorted it all out for us by consulting all the different accounts. And, because one time, it says that at the end of Brahma's day, when Brahma felt sleepy and desired to lie down, the Vedas were emanating from his mouth. Apparently yawned. He yawned and the Vedas came out. And the great demon named Hayagriva stole the Vedic knowledge. Here I told you yesterday where there's an incarnation of Krishna called Hayagriva. There's also a demon named Hayagriva. And so this is where this takes place. Understanding the acts of the great demon Hayagriva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Hari, who is full of all opulences, assumed the form of a fish and saved the Vedas by killing the demon. Because at that time, when Brahma takes his nap, the waters come up and there's a partial devastation. And so that's why he had to take the fish form, and he killed this Hayagriva, the demon, stealing the Vedas. Then, during the Chakshusha Manvantara, there was a great king named Satyavrata, who was a great devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Satyavraja performed austerities by subsisting only on the water. So Prabhupada says in the purport, the Lord assumed one fish incarnation to save the Vedas at the beginning of the Swayambhuva Manvantara. Swayambhuva is the first Manu. So this is at the very initial beginning of Brahma's day, since there's 14 Manus during a day of Brahma. And at the end of the Chakshusha Manvantara, that's the previous one to this one, where in the reign of Vaivasvata Manu, the Manu who's the son of Vivashvan. So before us was Chakshusha. So at the end of the Chakshusha Manvantara, the Lord again assumed the form of a fish just to favor the great king named Satyavrata. As there were two incarnations of Varaha, there were also two incarnations of fish. The Lord appeared as one fish incarnation to save the Vedas by killing Hayagriva, and he assumed the other fish incarnation to show favor to King Satyavrata. Then he goes on, and in this, the present millennium, King Satyavrata became the son of Vivashvan, the king of the sun planet, and was known as Shraddhadev. By the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he was given the post of Manu, and therefore Vaivasvata Manu. So then it tells how this Matsya avatar appeared before Satyavrata. One day, while King Satyavrata was performing austerities by offering water on the bank of the river Kritamala, a small fish appeared in the water of his palm. Satyavrata, the king of Dravida Desh, threw the fish into the water of the river along with the water in his palm. With an appealing voice, the poor small fish. Isn't this a great story? I always love it when they're talking animals here. The poor small fish said to King Satyavrata, who was very merciful, "Oh, my dear king, protector of the poor, why are you throwing me in the water of the river when there are other aquatics who can kill me? I am very much afraid of them." So this is the Supreme Lord, appears as this little fish, a minnow or something, you know, a little tiny fish. All-powerful Lord, but now he's begging protection from the king. "You have to protect me from the animals," he says. To please himself, King Satyavrata, not knowing that the fish was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, decided with great pleasure to give the fish protection. So in this case, he was lucky. The fish was the Lord. So his animal welfare feelings, normally mundane piety, became Agyata Sukriti. You remember the story of another animal welfare king, Bharata, who saved a deer. But that, unfortunately, was a distraction. But because this animal rights activist, he was attracted to the fish, and in this case, it was some Agyanta Ajnata. Excuse me, it's pronounced Ajnata Sukriti, unknown devotional service, accidental devotional service. It means when you normally you're doing some good deed, but you're actually serving the devotees, it becomes more than just a good deed, it becomes devotional service. Like if somebody's stranded on the side of the road with a flat tire and you pull over to help them because, you know, you learned from your mother that you should be nice to people like that. But the person happens to be a devotee, and you help them fix the tire, and they get on their way. Then you've actually performed devotional service. So this is Agyata Sukriti. The merciful king, being moved by the pitiable words of the fish, placed the fish in a water jug and brought him to his own residence. But in one night, that fish grew so much that he could not move his body comfortably in the water in the pot. He then spoke to the king as follows. Oh, my dear king, I do not like living in this water pot with such great difficulty. Therefore, please find some better reservoir of water where I can live comfortably. Then, taking the fish out of the water pot, the king threw him in a large well. But within the moment, that fish developed to the length of 3 cubits. A cubit here is the word for hasta, which means from your elbow to the tip of your fingers, that's a hasta. The fish then said, "My dear king, this reservoir of water is not fit for my happy residence. Please give me a more extensive pool of water, for I've taken shelter of you." O Maharaj Parikshit, the king took the fish from the well and threw him in a lake. But the fish then assumed a gigantic form exceeding the extent of the water. The fish then said, "O king, I am a large aquatic, and this water is not at all suitable for me. Now kindly find some way to save me. It would be better to put me in the water of a lake that will never reduce." When thus requested, King Satyavrata took the fish to the largest reservoir of water. But when that also proved insufficient, the king at last threw the gigantic fish into the ocean. While being thrown into the ocean, the fish said to King Satyavrata, "O hero, in this water there are very powerful and dangerous sharks that will eat me. Therefore, you should not throw me in this place." The actual word is makara. Prabhupada uses the word shark. Krishna wears shark-shaped earrings, it says. But it's actually a makara. Makara has the head something like an elephant and the body of a fish. We do not see them anymore. But it's a sign of the zodiac. In the West, they call it Capricorn. That's a makara. Known as a mythological animal, except, of course, myth means that you haven't seen it lately. But so makaras are actually quite dangerous, more dangerous than even sharks. There are many dangerous makaras that will eat me, therefore you should not throw me in this place. After hearing these sweet words from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in the form of a fish, the king, being bewildered, asked him, "Who are you, sir? You simply bewilder us. In one day, you have expanded yourself for hundreds of miles, covering the water of the river and the ocean. Before this, I have never seen such a, or heard of such a, an aquatic animal." It says yojana shatam, hundreds of yojanas. Yojana is about 8 English miles. And then he says, "My Lord, you are certainly the inexhaustible Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan Sri Hari. It is to show your mercy to the living entities that you have now assumed the form of an aquatic." And so then, having had this realization, he then offers prayers to the Lord, first asking him, "Why, for what purpose have you assumed this form of a fish?" Uh, So the fish says, on the seventh day from today, the three worlds, Bhuvaha and Svaha, will all merge into the water of inundation. When all the three worlds merge into the water, a large boat sent by me will appear before you. Thereafter, O king, you shall collect all types of herbs and seeds and load them on the great boat. Then, accompanied by the seven rishis and by all kinds of living entities, you shall get aboard the boat, and without moroseness you shall easily travel with your companions on the great ocean of inundation, the only illumination being the effulgence of the great rishis. In every Manu, there's a group that become the seven sages, the Saptarshis. They stay in the constellation known as the Big Dipper. They will be on this boat the fish shall bring and then take them and then all different living entities. And notice the herbs and seeds. That's a good part. We have the story in the Bible of Noah's Ark. And no seeds are mentioned. There's definitely a gap in the narrative. Because if you have a flood for a long time, you know, the seeds are all waterlogged and destroyed, actually. Yeah, I have to seed it from somewhere else. But here the seeds are provided for. The seeds and the plants. And then he continues, then, as the boat is tossed about by the powerful winds, attach the vessel to my horn. This is Sringa. This fish apparently has some kind of... there's a whale called a narwhal that has a horn. So he has some kind of horn. By means of the great serpent Vasuki, for I shall be present by your side. Pulling the boat with you and all the rishis in it, O king, I shall travel in the water of devastation until the night of Lord Brahma's slumber is over. Now here it mentions the night of Lord Brahma's slumber, but this happens during the Chakshusha Manu. So where's this night of Brahma come from? So here's the purport. This particular devastation actually took place not during the night of Brahma, but during his day, for it was during the time of Chakshusha Manu. Brahma's night takes place when Brahma goes to sleep. But in the daytime there are 14 Manus, one of whom is Chakshusha Manu. Therefore, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that although it was daytime for Lord Brahma, Brahma felt sleepy for a short time by the supreme will of the Lord. This short period is regarded as Lord Brahma's night. It was a little nap. Prabhupada used to take these short naps. He called them snaps. You know, because this is a snap, so I guess he's using snap as a nap that's quick like a snap. He called them a snap. Prabhupada could just sort of lean back and close his eyes. Immediately fall asleep. He didn't have to lay around for half an hour waiting to fall asleep. Immediately fall asleep, take rest for about 10 minutes and wake up again and keep on going, so that when he would take rest at night, it was usually for only a few hours, 2 hours or 3 hours at the most. And then during the day he would take these snaps every so often. So this is sort of Brahma, a little short nap, or at least period of drowsiness. It doesn't say he actually took a nap. He said he became drowsy by the will of the Lord. And then apparently when that happened, the signal went out, And the universe thought, oh, it's time for Brahma's night. So the water came up. Whoops. Then he says, this has been elaborately discussed by Srila Rupa Goswami in his Laghu Bhagavatamrita. The following is a summary of his analysis. Because Agastya Muni cursed Swayambhuva Manu, during the time of Swayambhuva Manu, a devastation took place. This is the first one, when the demon Hayagriva takes the Vedas. This devastation is mentioned in the Matsya Purana. During the time of Chakshusha Manu, by the supreme will of Lord, there was suddenly another pralaya, or devastation. At the end of Manu's time, there is not necessarily a devastation, but at the end of Chakshusha Manvantara, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by his illusory energy, wanted to show Satyavrata the effects of devastation. Srila Sridhar Swami also agrees with this opinion. Well, that's the account that Rupa Goswami gives. So, he goes on, you'll be thoroughly advised and favored by me, and because of your inquiries, everything about my glories, which are known as Param Brahma, will be manifest within your heart. Thus you will know everything about me. After thus instructing the king, the Supreme Personality of Godhead immediately disappeared. Then King Satyavrata began to wait for that time of which the Lord had instructed. After spreading kusha grass with its tips pointing east, the saintly king himself facing the northeast sat down on the grass and began to meditate upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, who had assumed the form of a fish. Thereafter, gigantic clouds pouring incessant water swelled the ocean more and more. Thus the ocean began to overflow onto the land and inundate the entire world. As Satyavrata remembered the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he saw a boat coming near him. Thus he collected herbs and creepers, and accompanied by saintly brahmanas, he got aboard the boat. The saintly brahmanas, being pleased with the king, said to him, O king, please meditate upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead Keshava. He will save us from this impending danger and arrange for our well-being. Thus, while the king constantly meditated upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a large golden fish appeared in the ocean of inundation. The fish had one horn and was 8 million miles long. Well, Niyuta Yojana. I don't know the word Niyuta. Anyway, long. Following the instructions formerly given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the king anchored the boat to the fish's horn using the serpent Vasuki as a rope. Thus being satisfied, he began offering prayers to the Lord. And then again, I'll pass over them in the sake of keeping the narration moving in our amount of time. But they're very nice prayers to Lord Matsya. When Satyavrata had thus prayed to the Supreme Personality of Godhead to assume the form of a fish, the Lord, while moving in the waters of inundation, explained to him the absolute truth. The Supreme Personality of Godhead thus explained to King Satyavrata the spiritual science known as Sankhya Yoga, the science by which one distinguishes between matter and spirit, along with the instructions contained in the Puranas and the Samhitas. The Lord explained himself in all these literatures. While sitting in the boat, King Satyavrata, accompanied by great saintly persons, listened to the instructions of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in regard to self-realization. These instructions were all from the eternal Vedic literature, Brahma, Thus the king and the sages had no doubt about the absolute truth. You know, here's again where the text slides into the other story. At the end of the last inundation, during the period of Swayambhuva Manu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead killed the demon named Hayagriva and delivered all the Vedic literatures to Lord Brahma when Brahma awakened from sleeping. King Satyavrata was illuminated with all Vedic knowledge by the mercy of Lord Vishnu, and in this period he has now taken birth as Vaivasvatamanu, the son of the sun god. Prabhupada again says, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur gives his verdict that Satyavrata appeared in the Chakshusha Manvantara. When the Chakshusha Manvantara ended, the period of Vaivasvatamanu began. By the grace of Lord Vishnu, Satyavrata, who would be in this important post as Manu, received instructions from the second fish incarnation and thus was enlightened in all spiritual knowledge. Now, be ready to receive a benediction. This story concerning the great sage Satyavrata and the fish incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is a great transcendental narration. Anyone who hears it is delivered from the reactions of sinful life. One who narrates this description of the Matsya incarnation and King Satyavrata will certainly have all his ambitions fulfilled, and he will undoubtedly return home back to Godhead. Then the chapter ends, I offer my respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who pretended to be a gigantic fish, who restored the Vedic literature to Lord Brahma when Lord Brahma awakened from sleep, and who explained the essence of Vedic literature to King Satyavrata and the great saintly persons. Any questions?
Yeah. I would like to understand something about Yoga Maya. Is it possible to understand Krishna beyond Yoga Maya? What is Krishna if there is no Yoga Maya?
Our purpose is not to really. Our purpose is to love Krishna, not to know him completely, totally, and altogether, because even Krishna does not. Comprehend himself. What the Yoga Maya potency does is enables relationships. Without the Yoga Maya potency, there would a relationship between the living entity and Krishna. That is to say, a relationship where there's some mutual exchange of feelings would not be possible, because the gulf between us is so huge. By the Yoga Maya potency, Krishna partly reveals himself and also partly conceals himself. But that Yoga Maya potency also influences Krishna himself. He also forgets his position as the Supreme and therefore is able to become afraid of the punishment of his mother. You can say he's acting, but he's acting with total conviction. So he also comes under the influence of Yoga Maya. She's then called Leela Shakti. She's his pastime potency, which enables these different things to happen. When devotees catch a glimpse of Krishna without any Yoga Maya, there's a real risk of they just faint, they pass out, they become dizzy. Their minds are stop functioning completely, because this is described, for example, a couple of times, and because it always becomes paradoxical in a way that you can't understand. Lord Brahma when he stole the cowherd boys away from Krishna, and Krishna was himself expanded and took the form of the cowherd boys, and finally Brahma understands what happens. All the cowherd boys turn into Vishnu forms, and he prays to Krishna. He's totally bewildered, because he can see that here you are, you're there, all these other forms are also you in another form. He says something to the effect that I can understand who you are, and that I also am within you as your part and parcel, and yet I'm over here and you're over there. How is it possible? You're the absolute truth. Everything is contained within you. How am I here? How are you there? He's just completely. And then, after this vision, which is totally disoriented and dizzying, and Krishna says, Krishna expands his yoga maya, and then Brahma sees him sitting there with a little laddu in his hand. Similarly, when Yashoda saw that somebody was a tattletale and came running to Yashoda to say, you know, Krishna's eating dirt, Krishna's eating dirt. So she ran up and said, are you eating dirt? He says, She says, come on, open your mouth. So he opens his mouth and she looks in. She sees dirt all right. She sees the whole universe, all the universes. And so she's looking in Krishna's mouth, and the whole, you know, cosmic manifestation is there in Krishna's mouth. She sees this planet, she sees Vrindavan, and then she sees herself looking in Krishna's mouth. And at that point, she really became bewildered. And again, then she began to try to understand everything philosophically. And then Krishna expands his yoga maya, and they have a relationship. So, why would you want to see Krishna except on the terms that Krishna gave himself to you to see? Anything else? Yeah?
Well, I'm a little interested in knowing more about both this whole thing about Sankaracharya, his philosophy. Not that I want to get into it, but that you at one point in time said that it was self-defeating, and also that the Mayavadis doesn't really understand Sankaracharya.
Yeah.
So I wondered where to get in, like, information. Should I get information, or where to get information about, you know, why the Mayavadis are off, like?
Well, they don't really understand Shankaracharya. Well, I'll tell you about this, since you're interested, but because this is just my own understanding of Shankaracharya. Before I encountered the devotees, I was studying Shankaracharya quite seriously. I was a Mayavadi, and like everybody. Although Prabhupada said there's no harm in being a Mayavadi if you haven't heard about Krishna. I had been reading Shankaracharya. I had had Hinduism courses in graduate school, and every single course, Mayavad philosophy as presented by Shankaracharya was presented to us as Hinduism. Now, I think since that time, most professors know better, but in those days, everyone was still under the influence of the Ramakrishna mission, who propagated this idea. And actually, the first Hinduism course I had was taught by Swami Nikhilananda, who was the head of the Ramakrishna mission in New York. He translated the Upanishads and so on. So anyway, in Shankaracharya system, he presents this idea of, his idea is Advaita, non-dualism. Now, in his system, Shankaracharya gives you a kind of two versions of what God is, or what the absolute truth is. Nirguna Brahman and Saguna Brahman. Nirguna Brahman is the absolute truth without name, form, qualities, pastimes, or relationships. Nirguna Brahman is the one without a second. Nirguna Brahman is the absolute truth, and it has no energies. See, if there's the absolute truth and there's something else, like its energies that he relates to, that would compromise the absoluteness. It's the same sort of Tillich argument, and therefore there's just the absolute truth. Shankaracharya really teaches that Brahman has no energies. It's one without a second. And he argues that if there were energies that produced a world, then the absoluteness of Brahman would be compromised. So even though... Anyway, that's a whole... So that's what he says. The Vedanta Sutra says quite otherwise. And therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that Shankaracharya said that Vyasa is wrong in his commentary. And he does, in fact, do that, but it's in kind of a tricky way, so you don't notice exactly what he's done. So that's his Nirguna Brahman. However, otherwise, there's another idea of Brahman, which is that there's a God who produces the world, and that God is who's the object of worship. And this God, the energy, comes from. This is Brahman. Now, this Nirguna Brahman is Brahman when it's an object of knowledge. And the Saguna Brahman, the Brahman with qualities, is Brahman when it's an object of ignorance. So ignorance, in the realm of ignorance, Maya, is not just the world, but it's actually Brahman, the personal Brahman, producing a world. That's all in the category of ignorance. So that when Brahman is an object of ignorance, then the categories of God, worshiper, act of worship appear. But when ignorance is gone, then these distinctions vanish. Worshipper, act of worship, worshipped Lord, they vanish. This is the way Shankaracharya on the surface presents itself. Well, because what is the realm of ignorance? Well, it's the realm of duality. In fact, it's the realm of words and speech. It's the realm of student and teacher. Well, wait a minute. Now, what about this philosophy itself? If there's no duality, what about the duality between Nirguna and Saguna Brahman? This impersonal and this personal absolute. Now everybody thinks that what Shankaracharya is recommending is that we have this contrast, this duality in his philosophy between Nirguna and Saguna Brahman, and his recommendation is that we come out at the end by just accepting Nirguna and Saguna disappears. But you're still, as soon as you have an opposite, a negative, then the positive, of which it's a negation, is still there, haunting it like a ghost. You've got a duality, and you're saying you take one. So this is what I figured out. So then, therefore, what Shankaracharya is really saying is that the actual unified Brahman can be attained not by either rejecting Saguna or Nirguna, but somehow there's something beyond our conception that's simultaneously Nirguna and Saguna at the same time. That's what I figured out, that's what Shankaracharya is really teaching. And so from Shankaracharya, I got the idea that actually you should worship God anyway. Because even if you're in Maya, you should, you know, the Maya means you worship God too, you know. So anyway, when I met the devotees and I started to go to the Sunday feast. The temple president was a heavy person by the name of Subal. And they used to come to our Sunday feast almost every Sunday at the same time. A guy named Amrit Desai, an Indian person, who was a yoga teacher. And Amrit used to bring his yoga students, because he was attracted to Krishna consciousness, but they remained his yoga students. And he taught them Mayavani philosophy. But he thought that, you know, until you really reach that area, bhakti's the best thing. And so he took them to the temple. He really appreciated it. Later on, Amrit Desai became a very big guru in America, with big following and ashrams all over the place. And he attracted many society people in New York City to become his disciples. He met Srila Prabhupada, by the way. There's a tape of Prabhupada and Amrit having a discussion. I knew him quite well. I mean, I even knew him before I was a devotee. He was sort of running around in the same circles when he was a college student, teaching yoga on the side. And Amrit glorified Prabhupada, and he said, "You made it possible for all of us." He really liked devotional service. And he was always favorable to Krishna consciousness, but he still stuck to his Mayavad philosophy. It's quite frustrating. But Prabhupada keeps warning him about the dangers of sex life, which turned out to be what happened with Amrit. It turned out there was this big scandal, and he was having sexual relationships with so many different female disciples, and he was sort of deposed and sent into exile in Gainesville, Florida. Movement went on without him. But that was in the future. Anyway, Amrit was there at the Sunday feast with his followers. And so Subal Maharaj, he wasn't a Maharaj then, but later he took sannyas. He would blast. I mean, just give these scorching lectures. You know, it was so heavy. Against Mayavad philosophy and Shankaracharya and so on. So finally, I took up enough nerve. Afterwards, I would never ask him a question in public. He was so severe. That early temple that we had, there was a parachute on the ceiling. You know, a silk parachute was hung on the ceiling. Because in those days, and that was one item of hippie decor, was a parachute on the ceiling. Because when you took LSD and lay down, and the air currents moved the parachute, you got really nice hallucinations of it. So he had the temple room. They put a parachute on the ceiling, I guess, just to attract these people. So Subal gives one of his heavy lectures. And then afterwards, then he says, "Are there any questions?" Of course, almost nobody is frightened to open their mouth. And finally, some kid puts his hand up and says, raises his hand, and Subal says, "Yes." And the guy says, "Is that a parachute?" And there's a silence, and Subal says, "Yes." And then the guy says, "How much did it cost?" And Subal looks at him and says, "That is not a subject for discussion." So nobody ever. But so afterwards, I went to him and I said very shyly, "I said, look, I've studied Shankaracharya, and I said I just prepared myself to get blasted. I said, you know, but I think really he's really a devotee." He's really teaching devotional service. And I just waited. And then I was, Subal said, "Yes, you're right." And I was so surprised. He said, "Yes, he's Lord Shiva, who's the greatest devotee of Krishna." And so it's actually there in his philosophy. The philosophy of Shankaracharya itself destructs, because the whole system, with its contrast between nirguna and saguna Brahman, is that system itself part of Maya, or part of, is it in the system of illusion and duality, or is it the absolute? It has to belong to the illusory system itself. And so once you realize, the whole philosophy self-destructs. So if you're going around teaching, you know, the real thing is that you have to choose nirguna Brahman and saguna Brahman is Maya, you're still in Maya. Yeah.
It also says in the Chaitanya that his specific purpose for coming was to bewilder the atheists.
Yes. Well, the presentation of the bewilder the atheists and also attract the Buddhists,
right,
at the same time, because the remedial measure was that Vedic culture had been really severely attacked by Buddhist philosophy, and the Brahminical order was all over. And so to restore it, Shankaracharya took, I mean, the Buddhist ideal of nirvana is exclusively defined in negative terms. One major school is the shunyata, is void. And Shankaracharya says, no, it's not void, it's Brahman. It's all in the Vedas, but it's Brahman without name, form, qualities, and pastimes. It's the same thing as void, you know, just under another nomenclature. So these people could, is like what they call bridge preaching sometimes. they can make a transition to at least accepting the Vedas. And so that way, and the other thing Shankaracharya did was restore the Brahminical order with the smarter system. He put that together so that the priesthood was again reestablished, because all that had been dismantled by Buddhism quite severely. Buddhism was a kind of Protestant rebellion led by Kshatriyas. There were two anti-Brahminical rebellions. One was from the Vaishya community, that was the Jain religion, and one from the Kshatriyas, that was the Buddhists. Thing that happened. And so Shankaracharya was the first of a Vedic restoration. But he covered the actual meaning of the Vedanta Sutra, and by giving it this Mayavadi explanation. Then there are Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, actually restored the original meaning of what was originally the Vedic culture before Buddhism. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he discusses Vedanta with Prakasananda Saraswati and also with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, when he gives his account of the Vedanta Sutras with the personal absolute truth and describes it, the reaction of everybody is that suddenly, well, everything he's saying is self-evident. And he says this, the Vedas are swatta pramana. When you really understand the Vedas, you see that it's self-evident. The truth is self-evident. Or self-luminous. That's why Prabhupada's idea of what a commentary is just clear out the garbage that's in the way so that the actual meaning can shine forth. You don't bring your own complications to it to screw out some new meaning, as he says. But to make it possible, make self-evidence possible, because you can say something is self-evident, but then you have to say, well, self-evident to whom? Obviously not everybody. No. So self-evidence also requires some kind of process, so you can be in a position to perceive it. And when you perceive it, then you say, oh yeah, that's right, that's what this is. This is obviously the truth. I should have seen it all along. It's self-evidently. So, just like at the end of the Svetashvatara Upanishad, How should you understand the Vedas? Well, if you want to understand the Vedas, you have to be in a certain frame of mind to begin with. You have to have certain characteristics. You have to be a great soul who has bhakti for the Lord and for the spiritual master. Then the meanings, the artha of all these discussions, that is the whole Upanishad you've just read, prakasante, it will shine forth. The purport will shine forth. This is revelation. This is self-evidence. But you have to be in a position to receive it. So when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explained Vedanta Sutra, using without Shankaracharya's imposition of this impersonal Brahman, suddenly everything made sense. Suddenly the text became coherent. Everything fit together very nicely and neatly and elegantly. There was, none of this stuff of trying to scratch your nose by reaching around your head and from the other side and all those things. And it was all the texts were accounted for. They were accounted for with the minimum, with no contradiction. And it was done in the simplest possible way. It was quite, what they say in mathematics, elegant. Everybody said, that's what it says. That's what it says. Well, this is a few things about Shankaracharya.
But could you then say that Buddhists, they are a kind of jnani yogis who are frustrated with material life?
Yeah, it's very much frustrated with material life. That's why in these, there's a very big, Buddhism starts with a kind of violent rejection of the Karmakanda section of the Vedas and the animal sacrifice and everything. And in these things, the notion that the world is an illusion. I mean, how bad is the world? Well, according to the Mayavad philosophy or Shunyavadi philosophy, it's so bad it doesn't even exist. It's not even there. It's completely. How far can you demote something down to nothing? So it's definitely against the world. Name, form, quality, these things are so awful. They're so horrible. They have no place in existence even. It's just they're all completely illusion. And they're mithya. They really don't exist. It's not that you've seen them wrong. They're not there.
And they say nothing exists then?
They Brahma Satya Jagan Mithya. That's the slogan. The Brahman alone is Satya, it's real. And Jagan, this world, mithya. Which means it doesn't exist. They have a problem with dealing with the concept of Maya. What Shankara says is sadasat anirvachaniya. It cannot be spoken of either as existing or as not existing. Because if there is no Maya, what are we trying to get out of? So for some time it has to be there, and sometimes it's not there at all. And you want to have it both ways, so you say this sadasat. It cannot be spoken of either as existing or as not existing. Because it just floats around there. I mean, if you ask yourself, whose Maya is it? So there's Maya. Whose Maya is it? Who's covered by Maya? Well, it can't be Brahman that's covered by Maya. Because if it's Brahman's Maya, then Maya is greater than Brahman. Well, maybe it's the Jiva's. That's the Jiva's Maya. But wait a minute. The idea of the Jiva exists only as a product of Maya, according to them. So it's not. So whose Maya is it? It's an anomaly. So you say, when you're enlightened, there's no Maya, but why do I have to get enlightened? If one person is enlightened, everyone should be enlightened, because there's no duality. What's going on? Anyway, these things go on like this. Fortunately, I don't have to defend that philosophy anymore. it's a reaction. First, people are trying to enjoy like crazy in the world, and they find they suffer like hell. Very typical in human life that when people find they're doing something stupid, they go and do just the opposite thing, which usually turns out to be another kind of stupidity. So people go from one extreme to another. So they're trying to enjoy in the world and they're suffering. So then they just turn around and the world is evil, false, horrible. Everything in it is no good. It's all Maya. And so they become Mayavadis. And so it's this radical rejection of the world. Whereas the truth of the matter is that the world itself is Krishna's energy. It should not be rejected. And the bad quality comes from our trying to enjoy it instead of engage it in Krishna's service. And that's the middle way. What Buddha says, the middle way, that's actually the middle way. And we should stop now. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.